Why do we feel a pang of guilt when breaking a promise, even when no one's watching? What invisible thread connects our sense of right and wrong? Ethics isn't some abstract philosophical puzzle confined to ivory towers. It shapes every choice we make, from the coffee we buy to the relationships we nurture. Yet for something so fundamental to human existence, ethics remains surprisingly contested terrain. We all navigate moral questions daily, but few of us pause to examine the foundations beneath our judgments. Think of ethics as a kind of atmosphere, an ethical environment as vital to our existence as the air we breathe. This moral climate determines what we find acceptable or contemptible, shapes our emotional responses, and establishes our standards of behavior. Interestingly, this atmosphere isn't maintained solely by philosophers in seminar rooms. A single photograph of children fleeing napalm has likely accomplished more moral awakening than volumes of academic theory. Novelists like Harriet Beecher Stowe shifted entire nations' ethical sensibilities through storytelling rather than systematic argumentation. What distinguishes philosophical reflection is its ambition to understand the deeper springs, the reasons, motivations, and feelings that move us toward certain actions and away from others. It's fundamentally an enterprise of self-knowledge, though philosophers themselves cannot escape the very climate they're trying to examine. Ethics proves inherently disturbing because it forces us to confront uncomfortable truths about exploitation, inequality, and our own complicity in systems we'd rather ignore. For centuries, ethics seemed settled through religious authority, divine commands delivered through prophets and sacred texts. When traditional belief weakened in 19th century Europe, many feared morality would crumble. Dostoevsky captured this anxiety. If God is dead, everything is permitted? This fear rests on shaky foundations. Religious texts contain troubling precepts. The Old Testament God appears jealous, accepts slavery, and sanctions harsh treatment of children. Plato posed an ancient challenge. Is something good because God commands it, or does God command it because it's good? If goodness depends entirely on God's arbitrary will, morality becomes meaningless. Cruelty could have been virtuous by divine decree. But if God commands things because they're already good, then goodness exists independently of divine authority. Either way, we need standards beyond God said so. The virtuous person doesn't avoid betrayal merely to escape divine punishment. That's servile self-interest, not genuine morality. True moral action springs from recognizing that betrayal itself is wrong. We possess the capacity to assess any text's moral standards, religious or otherwise. Perhaps religion simply drapes our independently existent moral sense in mythical clothing. The death of God isn't a threat to ethics, but a necessary clearing of ground. If ethical rules aren't divinely ordained, perhaps different communities simply make different rules. This leads to relativism, the idea that there's no single moral truth, only different truths for different peoples. Herodotus illustrated this when King Darius showed Greeks, who cremated their dead, and Indians, who ate their deceased parents, each other's funeral customs. Both groups were horrified. Custom is king of all, Herodotus concluded. But relativism contains a tension. If standards are just ours, why should they command authority? Yet certain norms must be transcultural. Every society needs traffic rules, ways of handling death, property distinctions, norms around truth-telling and promise-keeping, restraints on violence, sexual regulation, and resource distribution. Relativism faces its greatest challenge when confronting abhorrent practices: slavery, caste systems, female genital mutilation, political oppression. When we oppose such practices, we typically cooperate with the oppressed within those societies. Usually, only oppressors claim to speak for their culture, while the oppressed have no voice. Relativism ultimately leads to conversation-stopping subjectivism, the idea that ethical disagreement is pointless because that's just your opinion. The cynical view that ethics is merely disguised self-interest relies on unfalsifiable grand unifying theories, Pacifism conceals aggression. Helpfulness masks power-seeking. Altruism is genetic selfishness. When someone rejects these interpretations, it's taken as evidence of repression, making the theories impossible to disprove. The claim that everyone always acts from self-interest is demonstrably false. People constantly sacrifice their interests for other passions, ruining themselves for revenge, or nobly sacrificing for principles. Watch for the common trick of redefining self-interest to include whatever someone cares about, which empties the concept of meaning. If standing back so women and children can enter the lifeboat first counts as self-interest simply because I chose it, the term becomes worthless. Similarly, evolutionary explanations often commit basic confusions. Explaining how we came to have mother love doesn't unmask it as non-existent. The starting point, mother love exists, contradicts the supposed conclusion, mother love doesn't exist. Genetic determinism claims our behavior is predetermined, making moral education pointless. This misunderstands how genes work. Our genetic makeup enables remarkable input responsiveness. We adapt behavior based on perception, adjust desires through learning, absorb information from others, and respond to their attitudes. This flexibility isn't paradoxical. Even programmed systems adapt. A chess program responds differently to each opponent's move. While some traits like hair growth are inflexible, our beliefs and attitudes show remarkable plasticity. Evolution equipped us with this responsiveness to moral climate. Ethics faces threats when its demands seem unreasonably strict. Consider thou shalt not lie. While we value honesty, real life complicates matters. White lies, lies to those with no right to truth, desperate lies preventing catastrophe. When ethics requires extreme sacrifice or impossible standards, many dismiss it as impractical. Yet ethics cannot be entirely dismissed as institutional control. Human life necessarily involves standards of living. While specific institutions may manipulate these standards, this calls for better ethics, not abandoning ethics altogether. Throughout history, humans have controlled reproduction through mate selection, abstinence, abortion, and tragically, which children survive. Nobel economist Amartya Sen calculated there are over 100 million missing women worldwide, females who should exist according to birth statistics but don't due to unequal medical care, nutrition, and infanticide. The abortion debate is often presented as black and white, but philosophical examination reveals shades of gray. Fetal development is gradual, and a fetus is potentially a person, but an acorn is potentially an oak tree without being one. Epicurus argued death shouldn't be feared. Death is nothing to us, for that which is dissolved is without sensation. Death isn't peaceful or dark, it's simply non-existence. When we ask if life has meaning, we must first ask, to whom? To an external witness viewing all space and time, nothing human scale would be meaningful. But cosmic insignificance needn't trouble us. Meaning comes from absorption in things that matter to us. A child's smile, a lover's touch, a well-turned phrase, not from some cosmic scorekeeper. Philosophers once believed ethical principles could be known through reason with mathematical certainty. David Hume shattered this view, arguing that reason is silent in ethics. The heart rules everything, operating within the world we learn through experience. When we exchange reasons, we presuppose something crucial. What I consider a reason must be appreciable from your perspective. Without this, conversations reduce to mere assertions. When someone calls another vicious rather than my enemy, they express sentiments they expect others to share, adopting a point of view common to him with others. We can't literally feel another's pain, but we can take up others' reasons and make them our own. The person wanting to move the piano, their discomfort becomes our motivation. No God wrote moral laws into the universe, yet we humans have these concerns. We need behavioral standards for ourselves and recognition from others. Our task isn't answering relativism through metaphysical tricks, but responding from within standards we already uphold. We can admit these standards are ours, just ours. But this understanding needn't be corrosive. It can energize us to defend them when threatened. There are countless small certainties. Happiness is preferable to misery, dignity better than humiliation. In recognizing our shared humanity, we create the very foundations we seek.